This is Eric Solis, founder and CEO of MovoCash, and this is my startup story.
Every wildfire began with a spark. Every superhero has an origin story. And every single startup has a moment that they point to as their beginning. And every founder has a purpose that drove them in the midst of all obstacles. That is the startup story. The startup story would not be possible if it wasn't for the support of our sponsor, MovoCash. Move money like a miracle with MovoCash, the free money app that kicks cash. Download MovoCash app on iTunes or Google Play today, and you'll get your slick new Movo card in the mail. You are no longer dependent upon digital currency alone, but you'll have a card that allows you to purchase at POS stations, restaurants, buy online, anywhere that you want to use your money. No credit check, no credit impact, quick direct deposit, FDIC insured, and free to register and activate. Support our sponsor, MovoCash. Visit movo.cash or thestartupstory.co/movocash. I want to start this week's episode off by saying thank you to all the listeners and subscribers. We continue to grow each week, and it is only because of you and others like Editing Excitable, who left a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. They wrote, "I'm a very small online boutique that truly believes in our product. It's innovative and creative and different, and it's been a struggle getting it to soar as fast and as high as I want it to. The startup story has provided inspiration and mental vigor into my life to keep me going. My favorite part about it is how heartfelt every story is. Unlike the traditional cutthroat big business mentality, every story reminds us of how we're all in this together and how we all need support constantly. Well, Editing Excitable, you nailed it. That is exactly why I started the startup story, to humanize the entrepreneurial journey. Editing Excitable, I hope you will continue to listen, and please reach out to me on Instagram at thestartupstory.co if I can help you in any way. Entrepreneurs support other entrepreneurs." If you have found value in any of the Startup Story episodes, please leave a review. I will continue to read one each week, so plug your brand in the review as well. Giving your business a plug is the least I can do if you take time out of your day to write a review. Now let's jump into this week's episode. The Startup Story is a new podcast, and if you've listened to podcasts for a while, then you will probably notice that the production quality of the podcast is really good for a new podcast. The reason the production quality is so good is due to our incredible sponsor, MovoCash. But to be specific, it's because of Eric Solis, the founder of MovoCash. Now, I want to have a moment of transparency here because our high-quality production can give the appearance as though everything is flawless over here at the Startup Story. This interview you are about to hear is actually the third interview I've had with Eric. The first interview was at one of my live events, and the sound quality was really poor, and we could not use it for our podcast. The second attempt was an interview where we recorded, and there was some incredibly valuable storytelling. I mean, really, it was one of the best moments ever in my podcast journey. It was an unbelievable 90 minutes of recording, except that I failed to hit record. Seriously, it feels as bad as it sounds. It was a total rookie move and one that I will fight so hard to never repeat. Like I said, though, I just wanted to share that with you so you did not think that in order to pull off a podcast, you had to be flawless in your execution. So now, as we head into our third interview with Eric, I'm even more thankful for his willingness to share his journey, and it speaks to his passion for entrepreneurs everywhere. Eric is such an incredible champion for entrepreneurship and truly believes that the startup story needs to get out to the masses so that more people would pursue their dreams by listening to the real and authentic stories of our founders. I'm so excited to have Eric share his personal entrepreneurial journey with us because it's a journey that illustrates the incredible heights and dark depths that the entrepreneurial journey can include. In this episode, you will hear how important it is to not go forward alone in your journey. You will hear how easy it is to fall into the trap of believing your accomplishments are solely because of your own efforts. And you will find encouragement in the fact that some incredible opportunities come when we are at our lowest and most vulnerable, as long as we just keep going. Eric's journey begins with very little being provided for him, and that resulted in a mindset where Eric was determined to go and get it for himself. Even at a young age, he was determined to not be limited by his circumstances.
It starts out really as, you know, you and I have had the chance to sort of talk about this, that, you know, I was born into a low middle class family. My father was in law enforcement. My mom, early on, I don't remember her really working. She was kind of like a stay-at-home mom. I think she did some waitressing. I remember her going, you know, remember being young and meeting my dad and I, you know, we'd go have breakfast and my mom was our waitress, you know. So, So it was kind of like that. And so they lived on my dad's salary and we lived in, I remember they called them the dream homes, these little Cracker Jack box houses on the north side of Highway 111 out in Palm Desert. And I remember growing up and all my friends, we'd be at school and it'd be the day where everyone got to order off the menu of all the little goodies and treats that you'd get. You know, it was really exciting, posters and all that sort of stuff. I didn't get any of that stuff. And if I wanted to have those types of things, I had to figure out a way to get them myself. So it was like, it was very much about, from a very young age, I had to fend for myself. Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, just those early years where, I was a strange-looking kid. You know, I had this bushy hair. I wore glasses that were real dark. So I had some deficiencies in the way I sort of like, you know, starting out, you know, I wasn't born with a silver spoon in my mouth at all. Yeah. And so those young years were formative and it taught me to be, my dad would say, man, Eric doesn't take smack from anybody. It taught me to be really tough. I was a tough kid. Mm. I remember one girl wrote in my annual when I was a kid, she said, you're a punk, but a nice one. Probably sums it up pretty good.
So when did you know, I mean, your parents, you know, were not entrepreneurs in your early childhood. In your high school years, as you're now developing a bit of a philosophy for yourself, did you know you wanted to be an entrepreneur? Or because of your upbringing, you having to do everything yourself, what was that? What was your mindset?
So, yeah, I like many young boys from that era in particular, you know, I did everything from having a lawn mowing service, a weed pulling service. I painted fences and houses and, you know, I did whatever it took to be able to have the things I wanted to have as a young kid. And that was sort of like developed in me this early on an entrepreneurial way of thinking about the world. Like, I remember, you know, I would clean my room, but I wouldn't just throw the stuff away, right? Like, my mom would say, get rid of all your stuff in your room. And I'd say, okay. And so I'm like thinking, well, you know, one man's trash is another man's treasure. So I'd throw a blanket out on the front yard and throw all my trash out there. And my friends would pay. I learned they'd pay a nickel, a dime for, you know, all these different things. And I'd end up with a pocket full of change. I'm like, that's pretty cool. You know, like, so... And then I think I've shared this story with you before. It's funny because I'd take the money I would make from the, but I learned that if you catch on to an early product that's got some sizzle, like Bubble Yum back in the day, you know, I'd pedal up my bike up the street. I'd go to 7-Eleven, Circle K, and I would load up on as much bubble gum as, I'd buy the whole box. They'd stick that whole box out there. I'd buy the whole thing. He'd go, the owner would like, what are you doing? You know, I say, oh, I'm taking all of it. And I'd go to school and I could sell one piece for the cost of the whole pack because people are like, oh, bubble gum. And so, you know, I learned early on how to make a dime spend like a dollar.
That's awesome. That is awesome. You know, I mean,
yeah. So, you know, those were some of the earliest signs for me. And again, it came out of necessity. Mm-hmm. That's the important thing, you know, to realize is that sometimes what's that desperation's the mother of innovation or something like that. You know, I think I learned early on in life that there wasn't anybody going to give me anything, you know. Later on, I have some stories that we can maybe get into where I learned differently. Yeah, but early on, that was kind of the way the table was set for me.
So what was your step once you graduated? I mean, if you knew you had to get yours and it was on your shoulders, what was your step out of high school?
Well, that's hilarious that you've asked me that question. I was a rambunctious young kid. My parents got divorced when I was 13, okay. 12, 13. And there was a defining moment right around that point that I'd like to share, if you don't mind, I back up just a little bit. You know, so my mom ultimately ended up opening up this little shoe store. Actually, it was a dress store, and then she got into shoes and closed the dress store and kept the shoe store. It was on El Paseo in Palm Desert. Back then, you know, in the summer, there's nobody in town. And she would do everything she could to try to survive these horrible, long summers. And, you know, and my dad left, and I was like 12 years old. I remember many times, you know, like she'd, you know, I'd want to go out with my friends, go hang out, do stuff. She'd, you know, she'd be all like, you know, no, don't, you know, she was like super lonely, really in a bad place. Yeah. One day I came home and, you know, I found her curled up in a little ball and in the fetal position in her closet. And she's just like, I just don't want to live anymore, you know? And I knew, you know, from a long conversation, it was always happening that she just couldn't pay the bills. Mm-hmm. She didn't know how to survive. She, you know, my dad was going through his own catharsis, you know, and he wasn't there. And so I just did what any 12-year-old boy would do. I got down and cried with her. And I remember at that very moment that I wanted to solve problems. I didn't have anything that I could articulate in my head. I just remember something going off in my brain.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I am going to fix this problem. Not knowing at all what that thought meant. I just got down on the with her and cried, you know, and we both cried together. And then my mom and I, you know, for that time forward, have developed just such a strong bond. I'm definitely a mama's boy, like for sure. Like, you know, I adore my mom and my dad, but my mom's special. So I remember that I got very involved in the concepts of business. You know, I was one of those kids like, you know, I remember I'm in the back seat. My mom, this before they got divorced, I'm like, I don't know how old I am, but I'm in the back seat and I'm like, hey, what is depreciation? And they're like, what in the world? They're like, I don't know what that is. Do you know what that is, Velma? Like, I don't know what it is. Yeah. And I'm like, and then, you know, and so I decided, gosh, I must have been 16 years old. I started ordering the, I got a subscription to the Wall Street Journal, you know, and I just decided I'm going to start reading the Wall Street Journal. I need to understand this stuff. So I was, you know,
like the Palm Desert version of Richie Rich, but without the money too.
Exactly. And I remember that I worked at this little shoe store and I would take my Forbes and Wall Street Journal with me to work and I'd read it on my breaks. That's what I would do is I'd read the Wall Street Journal. And I remember them going like, what are you reading? And like, that's really interesting that you find that stuff interesting. I'm like, yeah, really interesting. So then later on, I got my hands on the Series 7 books. And, you know, I wasn't one of these kids. I mean, my parents said, you don't need to go to college. I mean, I remember the word was fiddly D. You don't need college. And so I had never really thought that much about going to college. You know, it was like, for me, it was like, you know, you'll find a job and you'll do what you do. So I didn't have the pedigree to get a job at a Wall Street firm. I'd gone to College of the Desert, and my high school years were, I was like checked out half the time in high school. I sat in the back of the class, half the time wasn't paying attention. The other half I was peppering the teacher on mistakes they were making on the chalkboard. I'd go, hey, by the way, you know, like, and they're like, you haven't been paying attention for like half the year and now you're going to point out my mistakes. But I say all that to say this, that I got my hands on the Series 7 books and I had determined that I was going to become a stockbroker. That was what I was going to do. Mm. So I opened up page one. I mean, in the Series 7 books,
how did you determine that? Like, what was it about a stockbroker? And mentally, did you just think that solved that problem of you and your mother crying in the closet?
No, I actually didn't. There was really a connection at that point in time, really.
Okay.
It was more like, it was just intriguing to me and it seemed just so fascinating. You know, I remember watching the ticker tape. You know, I had no clue, but I was just fascinated. I just sit there and stare at the ticker tape, you know, as a young boy, fascinated. And so that thing with mom just got me thinking about Like, what does all this mean?
Yeah.
You know, where, what, how's all this fit together? I don't get it. You know, like, what do you mean mom owns a store and she can't make a profit? Like, what the heck does that mean? Right. Yeah. So, you know, it was there, but I didn't necessarily connect the dots at the time. It was just kind of more like, I was just following my instincts, right? If that makes sense. Yeah. And so again, back to the books, I opened up page one. I just sat at a table and just one page after another, read it and read it and read it. And then took it, started back over page one, page two, all the way through mountains of books and taking the test. And I was 21 years old. I think I was 21 at the most. I mean, I don't even think I was old enough to work in the industry by the first time I picked up the books. So when I was like to the point where I was just like getting 100% all the way through, like I get 100, take the test 100%, I decided that I would see if I could get a job. There was a penny stock firm. It was called Blinder Robinson, aka Blindem and Robem.
Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness.
So I knew for a fact that I wasn't, because I had, you know, kind of walked in, no one would even, the managers of the Wall Street firms wouldn't even give me a, they wouldn't even let me in the door, right? So I thought maybe if I strategically, I'm thinking to myself, maybe I could get a job with one of these penny stock firms, just get them to sponsor me to get the, to take the test.
Yeah.
Cause I can pass that doggone thing. I know I can. So I go to this Blinder Robinson had opened up in Rancho Mirage and in right here in California. And I said, I can pass the test. And they said, oh, we'll sponsor you. You know, they didn't care.
Yeah.
You know, like there's almost no, I mean, all they needed is a warm body to make calls. So I went and I took the test and actually failed it the first time I took it. First time I took it, I failed. I got, passing was like 70 and I got like 69%. So I thought, well, I'll go to, I found this school, right? This little class thing to go and I sat in for like a 2-day session. And I remember, cause I'm thinking to myself, I can get 100% on every single one of these exams. Like how can I not get a 70 at least on the main one? Well, come to find out now, this is me just in the white spaces, but they said, okay, now listen up. Do not miss this. This question, they would every once in a while, like every this one, you've got to make a special note of. It's not in the books.
Yeah.
You got to know the answer to this question. So I realized there's sort of like some hidden questions. There's answers to questions that are hidden, and that served me well, by the way, because once I realized that, I started watching for questions that had hidden answers.
Yeah.
So anyway, when
principle rings true in a lot of different areas, the hidden answers to questions that you need to know.
Absolutely. I mean, it's almost a biblical proportions, right? You know, the hidden treasures. So I passed the test and I never did work for Blinder Robinson, not even for one day. The minute I got the license, now I think I can work my way in. Yeah. I knocked on every, back then it was E.F. Hutton, Prudential Beige, Merrill Lynch, Solomon Brothers. I mean, I went to all of them, Smith Barney, and I just banged on all the doors. I got turned down by everybody, one after another. They all said, no. Even though I had already passed the test, they'd just look at me and they're like, no way.
Why do you think they turned you down?
Well, I was 22.
Okay. And the average age for an incoming stockbroker was
30 years old. Yeah. And they came in with experience, college degrees from, you know, some of the best universities.
Yeah.
Then they had at least a few years experience doing something else, you know. So you know, like 30 years old was young. Late 20s was like the very earliest. And here I come in and I don't have any of the right credentials, background, experience. Yeah. Only thing I'd ever done was sell ladies' shoes. So I go to this one office, and it was Beige Securities was acquired by Prudential. They called it Prudential Beige Securities. There was a great guy there by the name of Tim Biebelhausen. I just sent Tim a thank you letter. I contacted him on LinkedIn, quick story. And I said, Tim, I found him. I said, Tim, I just want to say thank you. Without you opening the door, I would not. And he's like, wow, man. He said, thank you so much reaching out like that. It made him feel really good. That's like
gratitude matters. Ago. Gratitude matters.
It does. So he opened here's what he did. He let me, I'll never forget. He gave me a prospectus and he said, all right, he goes, go learn this and come back. So I come back. He goes, go on that phone over there and pretend like you're calling me. So I go on and I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm like, hey, my name's Eric. And then he goes, he calls me and he talks me through my presentation. He goes, okay, I'll let you know. So some days later I get a reject notice where he's just like, thank you, but no thank you, right? You know, and that's it. Just pretty short and to the point. So one really cold, I think it was March, early March, I wake up, man, in the morning, still dark out. It's a cold desert morning. And I wait for him at the front door. And he shows up and it's like, what are you doing here? I said, I got your letter. I need to talk to you. He's like, come on in. He invites me in and he sits me down and he goes, what can I do for you? I said, I got this letter and I just need to ask you, what do I need to do differently next time to get the job? And he just looks at me and he goes, you want to work for me? I said, in the worst way. I said, and I won't let you down. And he's like, let's go do the paperwork.
That's awesome.
Just like that, man. Awesome. I was like 20. By that time, I had just turned 23. My birthday was November 23rd. This is March. I'm now 23. I'd spent the 4, 5, 6 months trying to get a job and get my foot in the door. And then the funniest thing is that his secretary was on vacation. She was on a 2-week vacation. Okay. And he looks at me and he goes, and he says that to me. He goes, my secretary is on vacation for 2 weeks. The way I figure, I'm going to give you her desk because I think you'll be gone in 2 weeks. And he goes, tomorrow morning you come in, that's your desk. It was his secretary's desk. I get in there, man, and I'm like, you have no idea. I'm like, this is it. Like, this is my opportunity. Yeah. This is it, man. This
what
is
you've
my
been climbing towards. Yeah.
It was even more than that, though. It wasn't that I was climbing towards. It was that this was make or break. There was no second chance.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I mean, a kid like me came from the wrong side of the tracks. I don't have the right, I didn't even belong there. That was like, and I didn't, you know? So here I sit down and there's all these guys and these perfectly suited up, you know, they look good. They all look the part. You know, and then there's me, man. And I'm in the secretary's chair and I'm just like, give me the phone, man. I'm like, give me the white pages and the phone. And I mean, I was dialing, man. I was just like a madman. And I, within like my first, before she came back, like she was due back. And he's like, I'd already generated like, I don't know, $7,000 to $10,000 worth of gross commissions. He's like, stop. I'll never forget. He's like, stop. He's like, he threw his hands in the air because he's almost scared now. Like, what in the world? Who are you? Who is this madman? He's like, stop. We're sending you to New York. We're going to get you trained. I wasn't even trained yet. I didn't even know what I was doing. So yeah, within a couple days, I only had a couple days to plan. They put me on a plane and I'll never forget, you know, one of the most defining like experiences where I was like, you know, I had a glimpse of that. Like breakthrough, you know, like just to really feel it. I remember I was on the 40th floor of Seaport Plaza and George Ball, the CEO, he's standing there and he's like, hello, Eric, good to have you, you know? And I remember I walked out, looked over the Hudson River. And I was like, wow, I like this. This feels good. You know, this is what it feels like to like accomplish something, you know? And so, yeah, so that was kind of like the early Eric.
What, just, you know, to not jump ahead to Movo Cash, which is where we're leading to, but to pause for a second and reflect back where you are now or where you are now versus where you were then. Does that sense of accomplishment as you're standing on the 40th floor, other than telling this story right now, do you think about that? Do you think about your climb up to the 40th floor for that moment and all the all the hustle you had to go through to make it yourself?
I do, because many times I feel like I fell from the 40th floor too.
There you go.
You know, I mean, you know, it's not a one way, you know, it's interesting. So like, just again, to like build on that. So I get back to my office during that time. And in 1 year, less than a year, I'd become the youngest vice president in the firm. And I was like the highest producing rookie in the entire organization. Mm. What happened though, and this is the one thing for young people, this is my shout out to young people. There's a difference between being successful economically and making all kinds of money and masking. I was still that little, you know, boy that had all those insecurities about all these different things, mm-hmm. and the kinky hair and the, you know, all the stuff that I talked about. I realized that my success as a business guy, I was smart, had sort of like run away with me, and I hadn't really developed as a man. Mm. Right? Like my character,
yeah.
Who I was maybe even not even flatlined, but might have even been moving in the opposite direction, because the success and being able to really kind of like have anything I wanted and nobody mm-hmm. to tell me I couldn't,
yeah,
created some really weird behaviors in my early, yeah. in my early goings. If I were to draw it on a graph, I would show it like, you know, like, you know, you've got like the axis.
A widening gap.
The widening gap. And eventually what has to happen somewhere along the line in the human condition of things, those two things have to meet. And for me, that, you know, that catharsis was, you know, pretty painful. Mm-hmm. I'm so grateful for it. I wouldn't change a thing, but the processes can be ugly. So
where did you go from that? Let's talk about that journey, because you're not that man now. So what happened? What was the next step beyond that brokerage firm?
It's actually part of it. So what happened is that, you know, here I am, you know, I'm making a couple hundred thousand bucks a year. I'm 23 years old, no college degree. Yeah, I just, you know, sort of pieced everything together. And the decrepit part of success, right? You know, young, good-looking kid making a bunch of money is a recipe for disaster mm-hmm. without that quality and character. So, and then I started my own firm. And so it was a Solis group out in Indian Wells. And now I'm competing head-on with all the Wall Street firms very successfully. Mm-hmm. You know, I've got a 2.5-acre ranch with cars and par-3 golf hole in the backyard, mm-hmm. imported sand for my special volleyball court that just me and my buddies would mm-hmm. use.
And you're 20s.
I'm 24, 25 yeah. years old, you know, and this, I'm living like a rock star. People yeah. thought it was, here we're going to get into rock star status again, because I have a relative mm-hmm. that I think you will know, a gentleman by the name of Mr. Sammy Hagar. And that is Uncle Sam. And so growing up, I really wanted to be a rock star. I seriously. So
when your uncle is Sammy Hagar, why? Of course,
well, I mean, you know. I mean, and I started going to concerts when I was like 10 years yeah. old. You know, like when you have a rock star as an uncle, you naturally want to be a rock star. So I didn't have the voice, and I couldn't play I took guitar lessons, and you know, I can play a G, a C, and a D, and I can basic chords, but you know, and my voice is good enough for the shower, and that's about it. I desired to be a rock star. So once I started making all this money, I could live like a rock star. Yeah. So I kind of had that rock star kind of like mentality, you know. And you know, all my buddies were laying bricks for a living mm-hmm. and digging holes, and here I was, you know, doing what I was doing. I did my first startup, and this is where the crack started, okay? So now I'm making all this money. My last year as a broker, I mean, I broke up, you know, I mean, seven-figure mm-hmm. kind of, and I'm in my, now I'm maybe 30. Mm-hmm. And one day I'm flying back east, and I'm flying over the Grand Canyon, and it's, and I'm going to give my age away, but got to remember, I started young. It's like 1999, 2000. No, it was earlier than that, 97. It was 97. And I'm flying over the Grand Canyon. I'm reading an article about the internet. And I'm reading it. Remember, I'm still reading the Wall Street Journal. Yeah. And it's about how Sun Microsystems and Microsoft are in this battle. But it wasn't so much about antitrust as the article was written. It was really about who is going to control the choking points on the internet. And I remember thinking to myself, I was doing, by the way, a radio show at the time. It was called All About Money, and I was broadcasting this money radio show. I was up on the bird and, you know, broadcasting all over Kingdom Come. And I had, like, Michael Dell on my radio show, oh, wow. Steve Forbes, and the list goes on. I can't remember all the names now. I had kind of, like, tapped into something. So I'm doing my radio show, and I did a segment called The Computer Doctor. And I had this guy who knew all sorts of things about the computer and internet early on guy. Like, this guy was a geek.
Yeah.
And so I was thinking about the internet a lot because I had this show and I'm, you know, mm-hmm. like we're talking. And so all of a sudden I'm thinking, here, you know, we've got one of the greatest innovations, you know, technologically in the history of mankind. And all that these guys are interested in is controlling it. And right then I remembered leaning over my mom and having that the whole purpose and intentionality of my journey was mm-hmm. to fix problems and be a part of the solution. Here I was helping rich people get richer, which there's nothing wrong with that.
Yep.
But it wasn't the it wasn't the burning call in my gut that I knew I was like that was my passion. So I thought, I wonder if I could create an online piggy bank, you know, and help my buddies that are only, you know, be a part of that solution and get here. I think I can create a system using the internet that'll allow the mass consumer. I didn't use that language. Mm-hmm. I didn't know anything about mass consumer type, but you get my point, right? Yep. Like the have nots, you know, the common people to be able to access the same kind of high quality investment products that the rich people have too, because now I could do it all. So I went to work on building a system that would essentially pioneered the first micro investment technology. You might think of it as Acorns mm-hmm. now or Wealthfront, you know, these robo advisor type systems company called Save Daily. So I founded that and launched the product and built
what year was that again?
1999. We were on the front page of the C section of the Wall Street Journal in December of 1999. Another moment. That was a moment like me standing on the 40th floor of Seaport. I was like looking, going, wow, like this is so cool, you know? And you know, I remember walking down the street. I was on like Fifth Avenue and my marketing guy calls me, says, hey, where are you? We're on the front page of the e-commerce section of the New York Times. And I happen to be in New York at just that time. And I'm sitting there looking at a picture of myself on the cover of the, or, you know, on the front cover of the e-commerce section of the New York Times thinking I've arrived. Like all that sand in my shoes from the desert boy is gone, man. I've made it. That was actually the very peak, you know, like when I say I fell out of the 44th, mm-hmm. the 40th floor, that was it.
So up until that point in your life, the opportunities were on a steep incline, and to use your words earlier, your character are on a steep decline.
Yeah.
There was a massive gap developing in character and opportunity. And this, you're saying, was the peak of it.
This was it.
What happened next then?
This is where everything that had worked all the way up to that point stopped working almost like in an instant. It was like, you know, suddenly I was there was no track left on that up and there was only nothing left but to reconcile and meet yourself and get, you know, in the trough.
So what happened? Because up until that point, your skills and your ability to execute carried you a very long way, made you just a ton of money. What happened at that moment where it was your skill did not serve you?
Well, it's interesting because I could, you know, it wasn't about execution. I could do all that. But the thing was, I wasn't emotionally prepared for what happened. And that was that my first marriage, my was coming apart at the seams. Mm-hmm. I had abandoned, for all practical purpose, my then wife for my startup. I didn't know, I didn't even realize I was doing it. In retrospect, I can see it very clearly. You know, it's like, you know, being on a weekend and instead of paying attention, I'm on the phone the entire time talking to my team. And it's easy to do, you know? And so suddenly, you know, she had kind of had enough of all of the years that I had the shenanigans and now this, and I wasn't prepared for that because I sort of thought that I could behave however I wanted to whom I wanted and I could always talk my way out of anything. Because that's the way it had been for me. It suddenly wasn't working. My marriage came to a crashing end. And from this is a true story. 2 weeks after I was sitting in New York looking at myself on the front cover of the New York Times, 2 weeks later, I was sitting in a room with a splitting headache because I went out and just like tried to drown out my sorrows with a bottle of something. And I was sitting in a room with a splitting headache, my shirt off, in a dark room, four walls around me. My wife had asked me to leave, kicked me out of the house. My board told me to take a 2-week vacation because they could see me spinning out of control. Yeah. And I'm on the phone with them and they're saying, time for you to step away as the CEO of your company. So within a matter of 2 weeks, I was out of the house. 2 weeks from the time I'm sitting there looking at myself on the front. That's an amazing reality check right there. You know, so... I'll never forget it. I was sitting in that room and my board, which was, I'm not going to name names, but it was a very powerful board that I had. The former CEO of Charles Schwab Investment Management, the former president of Schwab Funds, built it from scratch. I had a strategy professor out of Stanford University. I had a world-renowned guru who had written books on economics and, you know, some bestsellers and managed funds on my board. And I remember them saying to me, leading up to that, they said to me, you have one of the most powerful boards for a young company on planet Earth, and you don't ask for help. Because I'd never learned how to do that. I'd never learned how to ask for help.
You'd done it all yourself up to that point.
I'd done it all myself. I was, you know, I don't like the concept of self-made because that's even worse. Like to my mind's eye, that's got a really bad connotation to it, right? I don't ever want to be self-made. Yeah. But at that point, that was like kind of it, you know, and I didn't know how to ask for help. And that same board was on the phone with me and they said, we want you to resign. We want you to recapitalize the company with X number of shares. We want you to forgive. I had loaned the company, you know, $200,000-$300,000 of my own money at the time. They said, we want you to write off all the notes to the company. And you've got 10 seconds to make up your mind.
Wow.
And I was like, and I'm, you know, got a splitting headache. Yep. I've got all these, you know, sort of like family issues going on. I'm like, oh man, like I go, okay, I'll do it. And in retrospect, I would have totally made a different decision, but that's where I was at the time.
Yeah.
So that's a painful story for me to even go back there and talk about it. I don't talk about that very often, so you've drilled it out of me here, but that's a story that I don't want to ever forget. It's not that. It's just it's a painful time.
And I know it is, and there's similar moments in some of our listeners' lives. But there's people that have not gotten to that moment, right? They haven't hit that all-time low, that absolute point of darkness. So I want to ask one more question about that, even though it's painful, but before we move on from it. Now, in 2019, it's a different Eric. But you look at that, can you remember the mental processing? Or were you so entrenched in your arrogance at that point, it didn't occur to you until later?
Absolutely. That's exactly the right way to say it. I made that decision, but it didn't faze me. I'm like thinking to myself, this is no problem. I remember, I'll give you an example. I remember meeting with a friend of mine who was going to kind of like, he was a guy that I'd met and we were, you know, he's kind of like, and now I think back of him as a mentor, right? At the time I didn't have any, I didn't think of people as mentors, but I thought of him as a mentor, and I remember him telling me, yeah, you know, like, man, when I hit my time, he's like, took me 9 years to work my way out of it. I'm like, dude, yeah, that's you.
Yeah.
You don't know me. Yeah. This is like, what time is it? Like, by tomorrow this time, I'll be completely up and over and out of this. Yeah. I remember, it's not a straight line up, it's not a straight line down, and it's, you know, there's process to everything. Mm-hmm. But I'll tell you, when I think back on those times, I was like the year 2000, and we're in 2019, 19 years, you know. It's not like I've been in a valley for 19 years. I don't want to make it sound like that. But it's you know, the process of developing that character, the really understanding what it means to be integrated and have integrity. And, you know, am I perfect today? No way. I'm still in the process. Mm-hmm. I guess let's go there. Let's say it that way. You know, so the earlier you start your journey and recognize that you got a lot to learn and you sort of embrace that and you embrace the pain. I remember I described it to one pastor friend of mine one time. I'm like, yeah, I go, and I used the word that I'm sitting in it. And I remember him looking at me and goes, that's a weird way to describe it. But at certain times, you when you realize that you can't run from it anymore and you just have to be there and you just got to kind of like say, okay, I got to, walk it out. But at the same time, there's a point in time when you just got to sit and understand, you know, like I got to be with this and understand how it has affected my life and how can I rewire my thinking in a way that's going to have impact on my life and the people around me.
Yeah.
And so.
What was that journey from the year 2000 when all that happened to now? Because what I find interesting about your story is, you know, it was your own initiative and your own ability to learn and execute that got you there in 2000. It was also your reliance on your own ability and nobody else that got you to where you got in 2000 and that low point.
Mm-hmm.
But now knowing you in 2019, I couldn't even imagine that 2000 version of Eric that you just mentioned is who's sitting in front of me right now as we're chatting, because you're such a different person. And I believe it's that difference as to why you're reaching some levels of success right now with MoboCash. How did you get there? What was that journey from the year 2000 when you were self-reliant, you didn't need anybody's help, you didn't know how to ask for help? What was that journey from there until here?
I can't forget about ARC 252, because ARC 252 is my second startup. So I went again. Mm. In 2005, and I sold that company to a company out in Calabasas in 2011. And how do I describe the journey to answer your question? You're gonna have to give me a minute to think about that. When you were asking me the question, I was reminded of my grandpa. They called him Haymaker Hager. He was a bantamweight boxer, and he's known, you can look this up. He's known for holding the record for being knocked down more times than any boxer in the history of the sport. And getting back up, getting knocked down and getting back up.
So you're related to a rock star and a record holder.
Exactly. And my mom, my uncle, My dad's mom was no joke. She was like a 5 foot little, like Indian lady that would take on, you know, men twice her size. Mm. She owned a little beer bar out in Fontana for 40 years. And and if you know anything about Fontana, you know that's a rough place to run a beer bar. But what I'm driving at is that at some point in the journey, you've got to tap into who are you? How do you harness the roots of your upbringing? You know, you've got to find people, whether they're related to you or that you've seen, fight off the bottom.
Yeah.
Like even Sam, I mean, look, I mean, I was talking with a friend of mine who invited me to go to a Kiss concert. I guess there's a Kiss concert coming up.
Okay.
And he asked me to come. And I'm like, he goes, have you ever seen him? I said, no. I just remember when Sam opened for Kiss, like in, I want to say sometime in the mid 70s. And I remember he had just launched or just recorded the Red album. And he got booed off the stage. He got literally booed off the stage. And he was so mortified. The very next show was he was opening for Bob Seger at the Poly Pavilion. And I remember him, he was like, we visited him before the show. He gave us all red t-shirts. All they said was Sammy Hagar across the front. But he overcame his fear.
Yeah.
And I remember that. I remember him being so nervous. And the whole thing in the family was Uncle Sam got booed off the stage off Kiss. And it was, I think it was Madison Square Garden. And then I remember my grandpa, and I remember watching my mom, you know, when she got up off the ground, you know, wanting to go into that place,
yeah,
to being the longest standing business on El Paseo, like, right? So becoming very successful. So, you know, look, we all have people in our lives where we've seen them overcome the obstacles and the failures of their life. And I think that those are the richest stories.
Yeah.
Those are the stories that are most compelling, yeah, to us, right? So I guess this is a long way of saying that I don't think I did anything supernatural. It's not like there was any like one defining moment where I pieced it together one day at a time. I did my best to make good decisions, one decision at a time. I did a lot of forgiving of myself. I did a lot of forgiving of the people around me. I did a lot of reconciling with people that I had hurt. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are some people that still, that I haven't had contact with for very long periods of time. But at the end of the day, it's just about not giving up. I don't want to say it's not about quitting, because I think there's probably a certain time when you have to recognize it's time to quit something, right? In other words, not being a quitter, but recognizing that you gotta, that I need to quit this. It might be, you know, we in startup land, we call it pivot.
Mm-hmm.
We pivot.
Yeah.
You need to recognize when it's time to quit, right? My grandpa, who wouldn't stay down, you know, he ended up getting his brains beat out, and he was never the same after that fight. He'd have been better off like laying down and quit, you know, like, hey, don't get up, you know, just stay down. You'll fight another day. But not being a quitter, being an overcomer. If I had to narrow it down to one thing that got me over, it was being an overcomer.
Mm.
Yeah, I'm going to overcome this. You know, what does that mean? What does that look like? It means that you have a determination, you dig down, you find the passion, you find that thing that's going to, when your feet hit the ground, you're going to say, okay, right? Yesterday was yesterday, you know? And when you have those really bad days, one thing I was just like, all I got to do is make it to the end of this day. Because I know for a fact, once my head hits the pillow, no matter what I'm stressed about, I'm going to get a little rest. I'm going to wake up the next day. And when that sun rises, I got a brand new day.
Yeah.
And I have no idea what that day is going to bring me, but I'm just going to go for it.
Yeah.
So I don't know, it was a long way to...
I love that. I love that. So ARC 252, you said, right?
Yeah.
Your second startup after you were removed from Save Daily. And that leads us to MovoCash, where you're at now. How did MovoCash come to be? And do you feel like now, with the journey you've gone through, with the story of your life, do you feel like now you are acting on that thought you had when you were 12 years old, crying in the closet with your mom, that I want to solve this? You didn't know what this was back then, but do you feel like you're there now? Is MovoCash helping you solve that?
I think that I still have a hard time connecting the two. It's interesting. I tell the story about mom because I do know that that's where it all started.
Yeah.
I think that that planted the seed. How about that? You know, it's sort of like the seed was planted, but that seed has grown into something completely different. It's like the a tree, you know, a sequoia tree doesn't look anything like the seed that it started out as, right? So I've gone through a metamorphosis in my entire thought about this. It's what I realize is that there is just a very deep-seated compassion that I have about people in general, whether it's emotional, whether somebody is depleted emotionally, physically, spiritually, financially, is sort of irrelevant to my mind's eye. I want to be in, I want to inspire them and I want them to have hope. And I feel a very strong conviction about that desire to be a part of the solution along those lines. So for me now, Movo is about creating a lifestyle. You know, like we call our people Movoians. You know, because it's like, you know, this is where, this is a, it's not just about a payments company. I mean, the payments is the means to the end.
Yeah.
You know, it's a thing that gives us something to do, but it isn't really what, the vision's really much more about where people feel like they belong. And I mean that.
Yeah.
I'm not just, you know, that's just not, I want to inspire people. Yeah, you know, if I can help them to have a more secure life, you know, through financial inclusion and well-being. But if you're, if you have financial well-being, but you're still, you know, sort of like empty, where joy and peace and love land in your heart, then what good have we really, what have we really done? So, you know, and by the way, if all my Movoians from the team were here, they'd say, yep, this is what we talk about. This is no joke. This is how we approach our business. Yeah. It's all about our vision is in fact love, unity, peace, power, anointing. It's not about building a $1 billion company or a $70 billion company. You know, obviously we would like to, we understand that the key performance indicators and the report cards and, you know, having good strategy and good execution, all that is vital.
Yeah.
Okay. But we know how to do that.
Yeah.
The other part is, can we impact the world and leave it a better place than we found it?
Awesome. That's awesome. So let's break down Movo Cash, because you've been a sponsor of the Startup Story since the very beginning. And I am so incredibly grateful for it. I know our listeners, if you've enjoyed the quality of the podcast, you have Eric and the Movo Cash team to thank for that, from their sponsorship that allows us to get that great production quality that makes it easy to listen to. It doesn't sound like I'm trying to do it from my phone. So thank you for that and supporting entrepreneurship everywhere and the authenticity of the startup stories themselves. Like, you've been authentic and transparent today. So thank you for that. But now let's break down Movo Cash, because while I've tried to do a great job setting up what Movo Cash is and why people should download the app and sign up for an account, let's hear it from you, the founder of Movo Cash. What is Movo Cash and why is it different than the other payment services out there? And why should someone be considering setting up an account today as they're listening to this?
So Movo is different in that it starts with the recognition that people that are living paycheck to paycheck, and that which represents a gargantuan swath of American society, as well as you get into the far reaches, the global economy is even more so, needing speed of access to money. And then you've got to also, this whole idea of real-time payments is a bit of a fallacy, because you've got to be able to get money off of a ledger. So, for example, I say many times that Bitcoin catapulted us light years into the future where technology is concerned, but where access to being able to spend the money, it sort of like takes us back into the dark ages. So Venmo, by way of example, is another one that really cute that you can send emojis, but it, you know, and to pay, and I, you know, look, I don't necessarily want to insult their, the job they've done. That's not my, my point, but it doesn't help somebody who needs access to money quickly. And we find some really interesting stories where millennials were embarrassed to tell their friends that they don't have a bank account. Mm. Their parents were maybe here, maybe they're second generation Americans or whatever the case may be. They didn't come from a family where their parents introduced them to their 20-year relationship at the bank.
Yeah.
And all their friends are Venmoing money and they're like, yeah, go ahead and Venmo me the money. But then it's stuck there and they need it. Mm-hmm. So the recognition that Movo, the real innovation of Movo was, we call it real-time payment cards. And this whole concept of using like a mobile number or an email or a social ID or some other unique identifier to be able to send money to another person, have them be able to receive it, but not only have it just received and stuck on that ledger, but actually in real time, spinning up a debit card that can be used anywhere Visa, MasterCard, credit cards are accepted on planet Earth. Mm. That's real. That's taking a digital money concept and turning it into the equivalent of digital cash that can now be spent in real time, not only sent and received, but spent. And that's the part that I think differentiates us from all of our competitors. We, number one, don't assume that you have a bank account. If you think about Zelle, Zelle's doing a great job. But what does Zelle presuppose at the very front end?
You have a bank account.
You got to have a bank account. Venmo always presumed you have a bank account. Yeah. Cash out to your bank account. So one of the things that we did was to introduce the idea that you claim money with Movo Cash, and we, at the same time that we spin up the real-time payment card, we spin up a bank account simultaneous to it. Mm. So now if you want to use that bank account for direct deposit from an employer, or if you want to connect it to, you know, so you can go drive for, you know, Lyft or Uber or TaskRabbit, now you have a bank account that you can use. So that peer-to-peer system that essentially takes what is sort of thought of as a vertical relationship between an individual and a merchant, where you're essentially paying with a card to buy product. We do that, but we also lay it horizontally, meaning that I now can send you an invitation to become a part of the Movo ecosystem where you too have the ability to issue debit cards. So in essence, you know, this whole idea of becoming your own bank has been great in theory, but has not ever really happened.
Yeah.
Movo really is delivering that promise. We're turning each node into a card issuing bank. I can issue you a debit card right now from my mobile phone.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty powerful. And by the way, it's patented. We got a patent on the technology.
You know, it's fun for as long as I've known you and I've known about Movo, and I use Movo and I preach to our listeners to go and sign up for Movo. I'm now, as I'm piecing through all the different things that are out there, Venmo and PayPal and Bank of America, Wells Fargo,
Bitcoin.
And Bitcoin, each of them, they have an aspect that is easy, but Movo is the only one that really encompasses the best of all of them, because the beauty about Venmo is the peer-to-peer sending money, no problems, right? B of A or Wells, they want to charge you a fee for stuff like that, right? So being able to do it, Movo does that. You know, the downside to a Venmo is the card access. I have money in my Venmo account. Unless I can pay with Venmo, I can't access it right away. Movo solves that because you have that Visa card or MasterCard that comes with it. So Movo really has taken the best of all the different payment and banking methodologies out there and brought it into one, and you can do it all from your phone right now.
Yeah, I mean, the way that we define that in the industry is it's called interoperability. Most people think that only has to do with connecting blockchain to legacy systems. That's not the case. It's really, you know, how do we connect bill pay to P2P to a debit card to maybe you do have cryptocurrencies that you want to convert back into your into fiat on the fly. How do we do it mobily? How do we do check registers? How do we do a digital checkbook inside of your wallet? Mm. How do you take all of this and create one, instead of having, you know, 7 or 8 different apps to do all this stuff, yeah. which is the way that everything started, is like do one thing, you know, because it's hard to create all of this and build it all into one system. It's not easy to do. And so that interoperability is the real strength of Movo, that it is really, it's kind of like the, you know, we all hear about Alibaba, mm-hmm. you know, and Ant Financial. What they did was very much what Movo's done, which is that, you know, it's like a one stop, but it's simple still. It's light, it's quick, it's fast, it's not clunky, it's not heavy, you know, and that's what we've been able to do. And I think you said it really well, you know.
So one question that I like to ask all of my guests, because I think it's so critical, and I think having gone through what you went through in the year 2000, I think you'll definitely agree. But when you look back now at your entire journey, who are those people that you think of with incredible gratitude because of how they contributed to where you are today? And the reason I ask that question of all of my guests is that I truly believe that if we lose sight of that gratitude of their contribution, it will inevitably lead to our failure, because we are not supposed to be doing this alone.
So I have to start with my mom. My mom and, you know, my pops. My pops was my mom's second husband, and he you know, I adore my real father, but pops, you know, he that guy, he believed in me. He'd say, "Don't worry about Eric. He lands on his feet. You know, give the boy what he needs. Give the boy what he needs." You know, it's like he literally would have laid down his life for me. And, you know, and my dad is, my real dad's amazing as well. So I start there. People that inspired me, obviously Uncle Sam, you know, inspired me. He inspired me to believe that, gosh, you can accomplish anything. I mean, yeah. if he could do it, you know, and to have somebody that close to, you know, kind of like make it to the top of a really tough industry, yeah. You know, that spoke to me. A couple of guys, Tim Biebelhausen, a guy by the name of Dick Heckman, who and Dick Hoffman, there were two guys. Dick Hoffman was one of these tough Jewish guys. He'd look me in the eye and tell me, you have a few people in your life that like tell you the truth, even no matter how hard. Yeah. I didn't like to hear it I didn't like it. It wasn't fun, and I didn't think he did it very tactfully. But looking back at it, he probably told me what I needed to hear. I mean, really, I'm sure my wife. I mean, gosh, let me just stop there for a minute. Man, that woman, Michelle, she just, you know, like, man, I tear up a little bit on that one, because I'll just tell you a quick story. You know, when, you know, you're going through these hard times, and with ARC 252 as my second startup, and I'll never forget it. Like, you know, me being me, I'm like, that's it. I'm out of here. I've had enough of this. And she, you know, she's amazingly beautiful inside and out. And she goes, "Oh yeah?" And I throw my suitcase down. I'm like, "That's it." You know, like, I don't need this. I can, you know. And she just sits in my suitcase. She goes, "Well, you're taking me with you. So where are we going?" And I just like looked at her. I'm like, man, now that's a woman
right
there.
That's awesome.
So anyway, she kind of got me a little, yeah. So my wife has inspired me. Lots of people. Yeah. I mean, the list, seriously, I could sit here, we could take another hour and a half, and I could go through the whole list, because there are so many people that I am grateful for. Yeah. And so if anyone that knows you're on that list happens to be listening to this, yes, I'm talking to you.
I've known Eric for only about 6 months, and I could not imagine the version of Eric that he describes in his Save Daily startup years. Every time we talk, he always stresses how important his team is to him and how crucial his journey has been to him. Would he like to remove some of those seasons of pain? Sure, we all have those certain moments we wish we could do over. But Eric sees how necessary those moments were to shape him to be the leader he is today. In fact, in some of our outtakes, I asked him what his greatest lesson has been in his entrepreneurial journey, and he shared something so important that I wanted to share it with you directly from Eric.
What did I learn between the differences between then and now is how to ask for help and listen and get consensus and understand, you know, hear from your team. Let them speak about situations. We have what we call robust dialogue. And if my team were here, they'd say, yep, we practice it every single day. So I went from being somebody who didn't listen to anybody and didn't ask anybody for help to being the complete opposite. Now I want everybody's input. I want everybody to tell me what they think. And it's just a complete 180 in that respect.
This is the reality of the startup story. It's not going to be pretty. We have to learn from every single season. And here is the beauty of what we are doing here at the Startup Story. We get the opportunity to learn from someone who is farther down the road than us. We get to learn from Eric's successes and hardships so that we can take those learnings into our own journey to help propel us forward. I hope you will show Eric's current startup some love by downloading MovoCash and setting up an account. If you use any of the digital wallet services out there, then you understand the concept. The difference with MovoCash is that it really takes the best features of Venmo and PayPal and Zelle and combines them all into one app. Out of support for MovoCash and how much value they provide to you by sponsoring the Startup Story, please visit movo.cash and you will see the links for the App Store or the Google Play Store. Please download it today. Now for my personal ask. The Startup Story community has been so incredible with sharing our podcast with others. But we have more stories to tell and more people to reach. We are a startup, and the most powerful way you can support the Startup Story podcast is to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at thestartupstory.co. Share the Startup Story on your social media, either with a link or a screenshot. Make sure you tag or mention us at thestartupstory.co so we can see your help and say thank you for it. And lastly, share the podcast on your LinkedIn profile. The Startup Story is for entrepreneurs, so please do not underestimate the power of sharing the Startup Story on your LinkedIn profile so other entrepreneurs can discover us. In fact, most people struggle to share good content on LinkedIn anyways, so if you want to support the Startup Story, then search for the Startup Story company page, follow us, and share our posts to help encourage other founders and spread the word about the podcast. Every single founder has a story, and the startup stories we bring to you every week can encourage and inspire another founder. It might just be what they needed to hear to keep moving forward on their dreams. I look forward to sharing these stories every Tuesday with hopes to inspire you to start your story.